Hi, this is Jeff Sachs of Leb Yeshiva, coming to you again with Halachic Man, Chapter 12 of Part 1 of Halachic Man, picking up from page 72. Our series, as all of our series in this, as all of our classes in this series this semester, is sponsored, dedicated in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton, Zichrono Levracha, by the Beta family. Previously, we've been going a little bit back and forth Again, I remind everyone to turn on their webcam. I remind those that have their webcams on that your webcams are on. Previously, We saw this back and forth comparison between halachic man and homo religiosus. I won't belabor the point, and I won't excessively repeat. But remember, homo religiosus feels a sense of alienation in this world because he desires the supernal realm. He desires the transcendental realm, the transcendental experience. He feels that being trapped here in this world is a compromise, and it impedes his ability to access the full implementation of his religious aspirations. Not so halachic man, who understands that we are created in this world and of this world, and the halacha, the arena in which halacha is implemented, is right here. And however, even though this mode of consciousness on the part of halachic man is impaired at times, nevertheless, there is tension even within the experience of the halachic man, for he too is in part draws upon the same psychic sources as does homo religiosus. There is a way in which halachic man is like homo religiosus, and that does cause a tension. It nevertheless molds and fashions his spiritual makeup. Halachic man knows no fear or dread in the sense of the term. Remember this picture, I mean, almost stereotype of religious man as experiencing this sense of dread, the sense of fear here in this world. When halachic man approaches the world, he is armed with his weapons. What are his weapons? What are the devices that he uses to fend off the fear and dread? Halacha, his laws, and the consciousness of lawfulness and order that is implanted with him serves to ward off the fear that springs upon him. Halachic man does not enter a strange, alien, mysterious world, which is the experience that homo religiosus has, but rather a world with which he is already familiar. How is halachic man familiar with the world? Well, think of all those examples we've seen before, the sunset and the spring and the mountainside and etc. The world is familiar to him. He's at home in, halachic man is at home in the world because he's learned the Shulchan Aruch. I mean, not exactly, but you get the point. Because the halacha, insofar as it's meant to be implemented in this world, creates that feeling of being at home in the world. Rabbi Soloveitchik once commented, Rabbi Soloveitchik had the experience, oops, someone's causing a little static here. Okay. Rabbi Soloveitchik once commented that he had a very intimate relationship with Masechet Yomo, the Talmud that deals with Yom Kippur. He and his father were long accustomed to spend the whole night of Yom Kippur awake studying Masechet Yomo. And it was a volume that he wrote on and he himself taught, and it was a beloved topic to him. Much of Masechet Yomo deals with the Avodat Yom HaKippurim, the sacrificial order in the Holy Temple. And apparently he once commented that if you would wake him up in the middle of the night, he'd be able to do the Avodat Yom HaKippurim. He'd be able to, he wasn't, of course, he was a lazy, not a Kohen. But, you know, just hypothetically speaking, he would be able to do all of the very many complicated rituals and functions of the Kohen Gadol in the Beit HaMikdash on Yom HaKippurim, because he was so intimately familiar with it. You know, that sense of being at home with something, that through the knowledge of it, you recognize it right away. I mean, there are people who, people that work on PhDs, studying the philosophy of some figure, an ancient figure, a medieval figure, a figure that's no longer with us. And you spend so much time immersed in the writings of that person, of that philosopher, or that scientist, or whatever it is, that you feel that you have this intimate, close relationship with him, even though, of course, you've never met him, and he died 100 years before you were born, 200 years, 500 years. But through that, through the learning, which on one plane begins as a kind of abstract learning, you develop this familiarity. You feel at home in that world, which is now something that exists only in books. I recall hearing once Rabbi J.J. Schechter, who's now at Yeshiva University, who did his doctoral work on Rabbi Yaakov Emden, that very interesting 17th century rabbinic figure. By the time he was done doing the work, he felt so bound up with this person as if he knew him intimately. And he described that, near the end of his work, he goes to Europe and he goes to the cemetery where Rabbi Yaakov Emden is buried, and he's standing there at the grave of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, and like this, just this emotional outpouring, to be there at the grave of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, who he had been kind of in dialogue with for many years while he was doing his doctoral work on Rabbi Yaakov Emden's writings, because you have this kind of intimate sense. So that's halachic, man. I mean, we're talking about different fields here, but it's the same idea. But that's halachic, man. That he's not alienated from the world. He's intimately familiar with the world. And that familiarity comes through the halakha, which is very this-worldly focused. Halakhic man enters into the real world via the ideal creation, which in the end will be actualized in whole or in part in concrete reality. There is a recognition that the kind of ideal and the real don't always match up, but to whatever degree it does, to whatever degree halakha is implemented in the world, it is the roadmap that helps us understand it. And there exists between the two a relationship of analogy. Why then should he be afraid? Such concepts as nothingness and naught, chaos and the void, darkness and the abyss are wholly foreign to him. Those kinds of emotions that are so familiar to the common religious experience are not part of the halachic man's life. I'll skip ahead a bit. Halachic man is a man of law and principle. Top of page 73. A man of the statute and the judgment, and therefore he always possesses in his being, even if at times it should be afflicted with deep melancholy, a fixed, firm, Archimedean point that is outside and above the turbulence of his soul, beyond the maelstrom of the affective life, the true source of peace and tranquility. Even though halachic man is not impervious to emotion, is not impervious to melancholy, to even a kind of depression, nevertheless, he maintains this kind of even keel. He talks here of the Archimedean point, which is a notion from Greek philosophy. Archimedes, he's the one that said Eureka. He's the one that figured out how to measure the displacement of water that gets in the bathtub, shouts Eureka. But he's also the one that posited that if he had a lever long enough and a point in space distant enough, he could lift the earth off its foundation. In a theoretical sense, the idea that, in physics, how levers work, that the further distance you have from something, like on a seesaw, the further back you sit on a seesaw, the greater force you exert on the opposite side. What are we looking at here? Okay, REA posts just the material from Wikipedia about Archimedes. But that distance from something, here he's using it metaphorically, the idea that distance from something not only gives you a certain objectivity, and that's the point here, the Archimedean point that's outside and above the soul, there's a certain objectivity which lends a certain rational ability to understand and make sense, but also the degree to which some distance gives you certain power and control over the matter. Halakhic man maintains that distance from the turbulences of the soul, and that gives him a kind of equanimity, a kind of control over the maelstrom of the affective life, and that leads to peace and tranquility. Halakhic man vanquishes even the fear of death. Now this topic, vanquishing the fear of death, which is of course so central to homo religiosus, to religious man, which is something of a paradox, because religious man feels oppressed to a certain degree by being in this world, and death, to whatever degree it is a release from this world, should be something that's greeted with, but nevertheless it's greeted with fear and trembling, because it involves judgment and other things. Again, homo religiosus is a pure archetypical type. Homo religiosus is not the man of any one particular religion, but think of certain Christian notions of death. Think of even certain Jewish notions and traditions about death. And of course, nobody welcomes death. We're not a religion of martyrdom. And I'm conscious of the circumstances under which I'm making this statement these days. But yet, halachic man does not fear death. And he vanquishes it, the fear, through his this-worldly perspective, by means of the law and the halakha. He transforms the phenomena which so terrifies him into an object of man's observation and cognition. That if you can study something, if you can cognize it, if you can observe it, it doesn't have the frightening power over you. For when death becomes an object of man's cognition, the fright accompanying death dissipates. Death is frightening. Death is menacing. Death is dreadful only so long as it appears as a subject confronting man. However, when man succeeds in transforming death subject into death object, the horror is gone. I have a friend here in my shul whose father passed away a few years ago. And his father had been ill for a very long time. He struggled with a kind of cancer that kept recurring again and again and again. And he would go into remission. And when he was in remission, he was okay. He was able to function. He was able to work. He was able to whatever. But that the sword of Damocles always hanging over his head, the fear of the next recurrence was always around the corner. And for many years, for 15 years or so, he struggled with this. And then he died, unfortunately, relatively young these days. And at the funeral, one of the maspidim, one of the people that delivered the eulogy, said that the deceased had told him that he's not afraid of death. He said, "Death and I, we already have a long chavrusa. We've been there've been so many times he's stared death down, because every time the cancer would return, he would somehow come to peace with the idea that this was it, this was his time." And then he would have a refuah, he would have a remission, and go on again. That idea of part of what we're afraid of is the unknown. Part of what we're afraid of is the unfamiliar. But the degree to which we can encounter it and come to terms with it helps us prepare for it. Then he tells a story. This is a chapter that's full of these kinds of anecdotes. My father related to me that when the fear of death would seize hold of Reb Chaim of course being the Reb's grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, that when Reb Chaim Brisker would be seized with the fear of death, Reb Chaim would throw himself with his entire heart and mind into the study of the laws of tents and corpse defilement, the laws of tumah, of tumat met, the kind of tumah, the kind of impurity, ritual impurity that's generated through contact with the dead body or the presence of a dead body. And these laws, which revolve about such difficult and complex problems as defilement of the grave, defilement of the tent, blocked up to all these different sugyot in tumah, would calm the turbulence of his soul and would imbue it with a spirit of joy and gladness. To us it might seem rather odd, but if Reb Chaim would be seized with the fear of death, he would study those sugyot, not even such practical sugyot, halacha l'maaseh, because the laws of tumah v'tahara, purity and impurity, or pure impurity and impurity, aren't applicable today the way they were in the times of those Talmudic sugyot. But that by mastering the topic, by mastering an understanding of death through the halakha, it gave him peace of mind. When a halakhic man fears death, his sole weapon wherewith to fight this terrible dread is the eternal law of halakha. The act of objectification triumphs over the subjective terror of death. The mysterious relationship, the effect between the cognizing subject and the object that is comprehended, even though it's logical and not psychological, we're kind of like conquering it through the rational act, results in any event in man deeming himself lord and master with respect to the thing that is about to comprehend. By study, through study, you master the subject. And by mastering the subject, it can't have the same psychic hold over you. The subject rules over the object, the person over the thing. Knowledge, by definition, is the subjugation of the object and the dominion of the subject. Top of page 74. Therefore, if a person is afraid of a particular phenomenon, let him approach with the standard of cognition. And then he shall be delivered from dread and terror. Now there's a long aside. And that has something to do with the history of ideas and the history of Torah study in the 19th and early 20th century in Eastern Europe. It would seem to me, says the Rav, that this world perspective, the world perspective in which halakhic man has this kind of equanimity, this sense of balance, was the primary factor in the refusal on the part of halakhic men, such as Reb Chaim of Brisk, that's Reb's grandfather, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, that's the Netziv of Volozhin, and such, like to admit the Musar movement, Reb Yisrael Salanter, into the Yeshiva of Volozhin. We've spoken about the Yeshiva of Volozhin many times in the past. It was the center, it was the home address of Lithuanian Torah study. And it was the flagship of the kind of raw intellectual study of Torah, the center of the opposition to Hasidut. The Musar movement, and if you're unfamiliar with the Musar movement, it's worth reading up on it a bit. I presume there's a good Wikipedia article or two on the Musar movement or on its founder, of Yisrael Salanter. The Musar movement was a program. Yisrael Salanter lived, he was born in 1810, he died in 1883. So we're talking, you know, the height of the 19th century. The Musar movement was a critique within the traditional world, within the yeshiva world, on the excess emphasis on intellectualized raw Torah study without doing more explicit work on personality development. Remember, Hasidut begins in the mid to late 1700s as a critique on mainstream Judaism. It's, of course, anachronistic to say Orthodox Judaism because that was the only show in town. But Judaism placed, of course, central emphasis on Torah study as the main element of religious life. And Hasidut, which is looking out at a poor, downtrodden, not always learned population, think of the great heroes of Hasidic tales, the woodchopper and the water carrier, the shoemaker and the butcher, the simple, pious but unlearned folk. And it says there have to be other emphases as well. And it places stock in prayer over Torah study, on good deeds, on dvekut, on a kind of spiritual clinging to the divine. It therefore places an emphasis on the Rebbe over the Rav, on the charismatic religious leader who can help the simple Chassid attain those goals. The opponents to Hasidut, who were, after all, mainstream Judaism, and who take on this nickname, the Mitnagdim, the Misnagdim, the opponents to Hasidut, nevertheless, 100 years later, 75 years later, become subject of an internal critique. That we do need, of course, the yeshiva world rejects Hasidut, but yet still we need a corrective from within to place emphasis on personality development, on midot, that expression that kind of means our personality traits. This is the method of the Musar program. There were different trends within the Musar movement. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was the founder. Already by the third generation of the Musar movement, you have divergent schools around these kind of flagship yeshivot that were called Musar yeshivot, in which the Musar texts were studied, of course, alongside the classical curriculum of principally Gemara, Shas, and Poskim. But you had two flagship schools of thought within Musar. You had the Slobodka school and the Novartic school with different emphases. Slobodka emphasized the positive, the optimistic, the idea that man is great and can achieve great things. And since we are great, there's no reason to sin because we have this potential. And the Novartic school, which had a much more pessimistic view of human nature, that really we're a gurnished, really we're a nothing. And since we are nothing, since we are so lowly, how dare we sin? But in the earlier generations, the Musar movement of Rabbi Salanter was held at bay in Volozhin, in the great Lithuanian yeshiva. This movement, at the beginning of its growth, symbolized the world perspective of the universal homo religiosus. Halachic man looks at the Musar movement and sees a kind of a halfway house or a kupat cholim for the homo religiosus, who's going to be attracted to this kind of orientation, a perspective directed towards the transcendent, toward that existence lying beyond the realm of concrete reality. The emotion of fear, the sense of lowliness, the melancholy, so typical of homo religiosus, self-negation, constant self-appraisal, consciousness of sin, self-lacerating torments, these were all hallmarks of the Muslim movement. All of this constituted the primary features of the movement's spiritual profile in its early years. It was the practice in Kovno and Slobodka, different centers of the Musar movement, to spend the twilight hours of Shabbat as Shabbat was drawing to a close, in an atmosphere suffused with sadness and grief, an atmosphere in which man loses his spiritual shield, his sense of power, confidence. and strength and becomes utterly sensitive and responsive and there to engage in a monologue about death, the nihility of the world, emptiness and ugliness. The halakhic men of Brisk and Volozhin sensed that this whole mood posed a profound contradiction to the halakha and would undermine its very foundations. Halakhic man fears nothing, for he swims in the sea of Talmud, that life-giving sea to all the living. If a person has sinned, right, so for homologiosis, if a person sins, so you lacerate yourself. You beat yourself up. Halachic man knows that there's sin. Halachic man knows that everyone is going to fall and fail at a certain point. And the halacha, built into the halacha, is the mechanism of tshuva. If a person has sinned, then the halacha of repentance will come to his aid. You do tshuva, however you do tshuva. One must not waste time on spiritual self-appraisal, on probing introspections, and on the picking away at the sin. All that kind of guilt, you know, it's so classical. It's so not only is it so classical. It's so stereotypical, right? Fill in the blank. Jewish blank. Remember that old game, Match Game, right? Where they give you like a. I mean, it was a game show when I was a kid. There'd be a panel of celebrities, and there'd be a contestant, and they would say Jewish blank, and you had to guess what the celebrities would say. Right, so you could say, I don't know, Jewish mother. Well, that's a concept. You could say Jewish chutzpah. That's a concept. But the best guess would be Jewish guilt. Right, that whole stereotype of the Jewish sense of guilt, of the Yiddish mama and guilt. Right, that is foreign to Ish Halacha. Right. That is foreign to Ish Halacha. That is the mode of the homoreligiosus. I dare say that a lot of the stereotypes of Judaism are in fact stereotypes of the Jewish iteration of homoreligiosus. In fact, there are very few halachic men. If you're going to stereotype something, you're going to stereotype the larger category because it's going to be that which is more familiar to people. Such a psychic analysis brings man neither to fear nor to love of God, nor, most fundamental of all, to the knowledge and cognition of the Torah. Now, of course, this is a statement being written by somebody who was born and bred and raised and nourished within the tradition of Brisk. Presumably, descendants of the Musar movement would give a different presentation. You remember that story about the Tkiat Shofar? About the Chassid who starts crying. We saw it a few chapters ago. About the Chassid who starts crying and comes down for Tkiat Shofar. And the Rav's father says to him, why are you crying? Do you cry when you shake the lulav? So that's brought as a kind of exemplary mindset. That's a description of the halachic man. Even though I suggested my reading was such that the Rav then kind of parenthetically, by explaining the point of view of the halachic man, was issuing a mild critique. Because the Rav himself did not fully identify with the personality he's extolling. Because the Rav himself did see room for the expression of emotion within religious life in a way that halachic man might not have. But there's a story that, this story, the story as told about the Baal Tokeya, the shofar blower, was told to Rav Eliyashiv, who was someone that had more exposure to the world of Musar. And he was quite critical. He said, how could you do that to the poor Chosin? How could you ruin his Rosh Hashanah that way? So presumably the Musar school would present all this differently. Man's entire psychic being must be committed to the regime of the cognition of halacha, and it is through such service that man can be saved from experiencing despair. The disjunctive emotions of fear and anxiety, if not rooted in halakha, will give rise to destructive consequences that will far outweigh any putative gains. And all that whole mindset of guilt and fear and anxiety, all these like these typical Jewish New York Jew emotions, this is not the Jewish worldview according to halakha. And here's another anecdote. Rav Itzila Blazer, or Isaac Blazer, who was known as Rav Itzila Petterberg because he was from St. Petersburg. So Rav Yitzchak Blazer, who was a Talmud he was the first great Talmud of Rav Yisrael Salanter, of the founder of the Musar movement. So Rav Chaim's reply to Rav Itzila Blazer, when the latter came to Volozhin in an attempt to persuade the heads of the yeshiva to introduce the study of Musar in their academy, is well known. Rav Blazer, in support of his position, cited a statement of the sages. It's a Gemara in Brachos. A man should always incite the good impulse, the Yetzer HaTov, to fight against the Yetzer Hara. If you can subdue the Yetzer Hara, well and good. If not, let him study Torah. If he subdues it, well and good. If not, let him remind himself of the day of death. So Rav Itzila Blazer said, look, in the fight against the Yetzer Hara, to fight against the evil impulse, to be cognizant of the day of death, to be cognizant of the Yom HaDin, of the day of judgment, it can be a good motivator. Because you're going to have to answer for your sins. Evidently, Rav Blazer emphasized, the sages prefer the effectiveness of the remembrance of the day of death to the study of Torah. For do we not have here stated that at times occupying oneself with Torah will not subdue the evil impulse, while the remembrance of the day of death will vanquish it? You have the Yetzer Hara, so what should you do? Well, learn Torah. And if that doesn't work, think about death, because death will get you to do the right thing, because you'll be afraid. So that was the strategy of the Muslim movement. Rav Chaim replied, if a person is sick, we prescribe castor oil for him, meaning we give him medicine. However, it's certain that if a healthy person ingests castor oil, he'll become very sick. Because if you're sick, you can take medicine. Right? But if you're not sick and you take medicine, you can really get sick. It could be that in mild doses, some of the strategies of the Musar movement are effective correctives. But it's not a curriculum to be implemented across the board. Psychiatry, both talk therapy and the pharmacological variety, can be very effective at helping people, whatever percentage of the population, it's certainly not the majority, whatever percentage of the population need to be sitting on someone's couch. But if we would subject everybody to it, it would liable have a negative effect. If that vile wretch, if the Yetzer Hara, the evil impulse, meets you, and you are sound in spirit and soul, if your consciousness and character are still whole and intact, occupy yourself with Torah, drag into the house of study. The remedy for the Yetzer Hara is Torah study. The remedy for the Yetzer Hara is the Beit Midrash. This is the most effective and tried remedy in man's ongoing battle with his evil impulse. However, if you're spiritually sick, if a fit of madness has seized hold of you, if some psychic anomaly has put forth its diseased tendrils in your inner world, then you must use more powerful drugs, those that are designed for the very ill. The remembrance of the day of death. We in Volozhin, thank God, are healthy in spirit and body, are whole in our soul. There's no need here for castor oil. If the scholars of Kelman Kovno feel compelled to drink bitter drugs, if the Musarniks want to take this medicine, bevakasha, to your heart's content. But don't let other, don't, but let them not invite others to dine with them. Right? That mussar should be used as a corrective for those in need. But it is not a remedy. It is not a curriculum to be implemented across the board. He then comes back, but it's precisely because of this, because halachic man has this kind of equanimity. He's got this kind of balanced outlook. The halacha keeps him grounded. He doesn't experience depression and anxiety. Of course, he's not speaking here diagnostically. Of course, everybody experiences different emotions. Because in the real world, no one is the halachic man, and no one is the homoreligiosus, and no one is the cognitive man. We have each of these elements in our personalities. Nobody should read halachic man as a psychology manual. But the pure types, now having been put to the centrifuge and separated out into their pure archetypes. So halachic man, he doesn't suffer from this. If halachic man, I'm skipping ahead a drop, if halachic man stays clear of melancholy and dread, he also recoils, on the other hand, from any exaggerated spirit of joy, any sense of celebration lacking a healthy logical foundation, any spiritual drunkenness. So just like he doesn't give into depression, doesn't give into excess jocularity, halachic man is characterized by an almost festive dignity or an attitude of solemnity. That's a beautiful phrase, festive dignity. It almost sounds like an oxymoron, right? But it's not. It's the dignity. There's a dignity. There's a self-control that can be exercised together with festivity, with joy. And he points out that he's borrowing these phrases from William James's Variety of Religious Experience. I sent you a link to this particular section. It's worth reading. This stance prevents man from being attracted to any of the extremes of the emotional life and places a bar against his spirit, which tends at times to shatter all bounds and restraints and controls. And of course, here we're reminded of the Rambam's admonitions in Hilchot Deot, which I know I have taught here in Web Yeshiva in the past, of finding the golden mean, of finding balance in personality, and the notion that all extremes, lakan lakan, towards joy or towards sadness, are no good, and we have to find a balance in the middle. Yes, Anne asks, does halachic man experience joy? So he's addressing this now. Joy in a sense of contentment, certainly. Joy in a sense of serenity, certainly. Not joy in the sense of wearing a lampshade on your head and partying until you drop. He fulfills the injunction of well-known pasukim Tehillim, if duet Hashem b'yira v'gilu b'ra'ada. Serve God with awe. We remember Ivduet Hashem b'simcha, but here, Yira is not fear, like being petrified. Yira is awe, right? In that sense, like the awesome experience of encountering God. So serve God with awe and rejoice in trembling, the famous title of Kierkegaard's book, Fear and Trembling. Gilu b'ra'ada. There's joy that comes about through being in God's presence, of being in awe of God. And these two things, which seem like contradictions, can find balance in the middle, that joy of being a servant of God. In times of mourning and dejection, in moments of pain and grief as well, he's not crushed by his burden, and he's not given over to despair and black depression. His affective life is characterized by a fine equilibrium, a stoic tranquility. That's the emotional motto of halachic man, equilibrium, tranquility. It's not that he doesn't experience sadness. Of course he does. The halakha itself mandates periods of sadness. Right now, some of you, if you're hours behind me, have not yet broken your fast, Shavuos or Tammuz, you're fasting right now. It is a period of sadness. We're entering 3 weeks of mourning. And similarly, there are times where the halakha mandates joy. On Yom Tov, for example. But it is always one of equilibrium, of an excess neither to here nor to there. And in fact, part of the halakhic agenda in these circumstances is to point us in the correct emotional direction, but yet to set a kind of emotional safety net around either side. It exemplifies the Aristotelian gold mean and the ideal of the well-balanced personality set forth by Maimonides in the Hilchot Deot. I'll skip ahead, and he brings again some more anecdotes, and these are among the most well-known anecdotes and also the most troubling anecdotes within Halachic Man and really within all of Rabbi Soloveitchik's writings. When the Vilna Gaon, here we are, here, the middle of page 77, when the Vilna Gaon's brother died, and the Gaon learned of it on Shabbat, when mourning is forbidden, he did not display any emotion or signs of grief. After the Shabbat, when he concluded Havdalah, he burst into tears. Now, we're all aware of this. I'm sure some of you have already had the unfortunate experience of sitting Shiva for a parent or whomever. But we've all probably been exposed to this. You have Shiva. In the middle of Shiva, on the third, fourth, fifth day, whatever, comes Shabbat. Shiva goes on hold, at least the public display. You're still technically in mourning. But Shabbat comes and overrides the Shiva. I myself was witness to an experience exactly like this, as described by the Vilna Gaon. Years and years ago, when I was a student in yeshiva, I went to someone's home for Shabbat. You know, it was one of those things, you know, when you're in yeshiva, you have no compunctions to call up somebody who you hardly know and say, oh, well, you know so-and-so, and I know so-and-so, and so-and-so told me that you make food on Shabbat, and maybe you'd like to give me some of that. So maybe I can come and bring a friend. So I go to these people's home in Kiryat Moshe, who, again, we only had this mutual acquaintance, and they were a very, very special family, really very special family, in Torah, in Chesed, in all types of things. Late at night, Friday night, there's a knock at the door. It's a messenger from Shari Tzedek Hospital come to tell the father of the house that his father had been rushed to the hospital on Friday night and had passed away. So it was quite shocking. So Shabbat morning, we get up. You know, and we're very uncomfortable. Here we are, we're guests, two yeshiva boys in this home. They just learn that their father, their grandfather's passed away. They get up. We go to shul. We come home. We have lunch. We sing Zmirot. The whole thing. There's no weeping. There's no mourning. Exactly like the story of the Vilna Gaon. And exactly like the story of the Vilna Gaon after Havdalah, come the tears and the emotions and the planning of the funeral. And it's a little hard for us to understand. I mention this story because these are people that I actually know, real live flesh and blood people. To hear a story about the Vilna Gaon, so we know the Vilna Gaon was the Vilna Gaon. But the idea of the halakha kind of is a roadmap also for our emotions is an interesting one. Similarly, someone dies. The family buries their dead. It happens that the day of the funeral is Erev Pesach or Erev Sukkos. They sit Shiva for an hour. Yontif comes, cancels the rest of Shiva. the experience that most people have, 7 days to kind of unpack their mourning, is abbreviated, is cut short, and they're meant to get on with the work of Simchat Yom Tov. It's hard to imagine, but yet it happens all the time. And now here are two stories that are... Here's the story which is the most difficult to absorb. It's a story about Rav Ilya Pruzhno, Rav Ilya Feinstein, who was the Rav's maternal grandfather. The Rav's mother's family were Feinsteins. That's how Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rav Moshe Feinstein were cousins. They weren't first cousins, but they were cousins. The beloved daughter of Ilya Pruzhno, Ilya Feinstein, took sick about a month before she was to be married, and after a few days was rapidly sinking. Rav Ilya's son entered into the room where Rav Ilya, wrapped in towels and tefillin, was praying with the congregation to tell him that his daughter was in her death throes. Rav Ilya went to his daughter's room and asked the doctor how much longer it would be until the end. When he received the doctor's reply, Rav Ilya returned to his room, removed his Rashi tefillin, and quickly put on the tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. You know, some people are accustomed. There's a machlokas in Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam about exactly the order of the parashiot in the tefillin. We follow the opinion of Rashi. Anyone who puts on tefillin according to the opinion of Rashi. Some people who are punctilious put on a second pair of tefillin according to the opinion in order to fulfill the alternate opinion of Rabbeinu Tam. So he had put on tefillin, he'd already basically davened, but he knows that there's only a short amount of time before his daughter is going to pass away, and he rushes in order to also now put on the tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam. Because he knows that immediately upon his daughter's death, he would be an onim, a mourner whose dead relative has not yet been buried, and as such would be subject to laws in order to accept all the commandments. In that most intensive period of mourning, from the point of death until the burial, the period of aninut, a person does not do mitzvot aseh. You can't do any prohibitions, but you don't say brachot, you don't daven, for example, you don't wear tzitzit in that period. For various reasons, either because of osekna mitzvah, patur mina mitzvah, since you're busy, preoccupied with this very all-encompassing mitzvah of being of dealing with the affairs of the recently deceased, and therefore that supersedes other obligations, or because of the mental state that you're thrown into, the state of intense mourning that kind of precludes you from doing certain mitzvot. So he knew he only had a few minutes to do this mitzvah, and then he would not, if he doesn't do it now, he won't have a chance later. After he removed his second pair of tefillin, wrapped them up, and put them away, he entered his dying daughter's room in order to be present at the moment his most beloved daughter of all would return her soul back to its maker. We have here great strength and presence of mind, the acceptance of the divine decree with love, the consciousness of the law and the judgment, the might and the power of the halakha, and faith strong like the flint. Now, the Rav brings this story as a demonstration of certainly a commitment to halakha. Certainly, maybe even more than that, the kind of halakhic thinking that helps you deal with the crisis, that sense of being regimented, that it orders our lives. You know that Herman Woke, the well-known American novelist, who's I think like 100 years old or something like that, and he keeps like writing novels, which is pretty remarkable. Herman Woke, who actually once upon a time years ago studied in the yeshiva, in Rabbi Bravender's yeshiva, has a nonfiction work called This Is My God. He himself is an Orthodox Jew. And he wrote a book about kind of like a primer to Jewish life and observance. this is my God. And Once Upon a Time was quite popular, particularly in the Balchuva crowd. I'm not sure if it's quite as popular today as it once was. And he describes, by using a metaphor, for time that he spent in the Navy. He served in the Navy in World War II. And he describes the regimen of life on aboard a Navy vessel. That there are all types of, well, what we would recognize, lahavdil, as halachot. Which side of the boat to walk on, if a person's going up the ladder, another person's coming down the ladder, who has precedence. All different types of things, all different types of lingo that are used, etc., in order to create a society that's working together where everyone knows what their job is on this boat, everybody knows what the ritual is, what the drill is. And he uses that as a way of example, as a way of metaphor for what the halachic lifestyle is. That the halachic lifestyle, the halachic commitments are there to guide both us individually, also as a community. The examples here in this chapter the Rav gives are all in the life of the individual. But the halacha is there to kind of shape and guide our whole existence, including our inner emotional existence. That being said, the example that he gives of his maternal grandfather is really quite shocking. I, for one, am prepared to say that I am insufficiently a halachic man. To whatever degree, this story not only shocks me, but even repels me. Ask yourself, if it was your daughter, would you spend the extra 3 minutes with her in the last 10 minutes of her life, or would you put on the Rabbeinu Tam tefillin? I can imagine what the Homo religiosus would say. We know what the halachic man says. Why Rabbi Soloveitchik tells this story, when I think he knew how the reader would respond, the emotional gut response that we all have to the story, is an interesting question. But it no doubt leaves us each with a question mark of how we respond to this. It's an aspiration that we all should have, that halakha should serve that role in our lives. But it's a reality that in negotiating our emotions and our feelings, which can be so tormentous, we're not all successful in regulating our emotional life in the way that halachic man is. The question is, do we want to be? So there's a critique here on halachic man, even as his mindset is held up as an exemplar. But this really is a case, I think, where the average reader will feel a sense of alienation from the halachic man. And we have to question what Rabbi Soloveitchik was thinking in placing it here. That's our job to try to figure it out. But I'm not certain that we have all the answers. We will continue next week with Chapter 13. Those of you who are still fasting, have a meaningful fast. And those of us that are on the other side, it's time to go to sleep. Erev Tov.